Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Our conversation today will revisit an investment theme which has been top of mind for many market participants, along with our chief investment office here at UBS, that being AI, artificial intelligence. So as this technology continues to rapidly evolve and influence markets, it does help to understand how we got to where we are, where we stand today, and what the road ahead looks like. To help us with that, I am fortunate to be joined today here at our UBS studios in New York by Zhang Zhang of Poland Capital. Zhang is the head of AI and risk analytics at Poland Capital. With a career spanning 15 years, Zhang started as a business analyst at Fidelity Investments, Strategic Advisors, and later joined Analysis Group as an economist and consultant. Zhang holds a degree in economics with a minor in computer science from the University of Chicago and an MBA from Yale University. At Poland Capital, Zhang leads the integration of rigorous data-driven insights across various departments to empower them to work more efficiently and effectively. So, Zhang, thank you very much for spending some time with our listeners today here on Market Moves, for making the trip down from Boston. Do appreciate that. It's a pleasure to be at the table with you today and very much looking forward to hearing your insights into artificial intelligence.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I suspect, Zhang, many of our listeners, myself admittedly included, are still in the process of learning about this rapidly evolving technology. There seems to be a fair degree of complexities involved, and AI is quickly having more of an impact to our day-to-day on a variety of fronts. So to begin, Zhang, can you take us through the timeline as to how we got to where we are today with the evolution of AI?
Sure. So artificial intelligence as a concept of wanting to have machines mimic human thoughts and human intelligence, that's existed, even the term has existed, since the middle of the 20th century. And I see kind of three distinct phases in how it's evolved through today. It wasn't a very continuous evolution, but the first phase, mostly limited by the very meager computing resources that we had, it was defined by essentially very highly manual, hand-tailored rules in a particular situation. If this happens and the user does this, then you should respond with this, which created some nice theoretical examples and demos, but it fell apart pretty quickly in the real world. And in fact, following that, there were a decade or two of what the field considers to be an AI winter, where there's just a lot of disillusionment over the promise of this. And it wasn't until the 1990s when the rise of machine learning really turned this around. And machine learning as a concept, it's essentially saying, you know, to the computer, here's a statistical framework. Here's a lot of data. Here's what I expect the correct answers to be. You figure it out. Figure out the relationships and the nuances between the different input and get to the correct output. And that was a more flexible paradigm to get machines to work with the noisiness, the messiness of the real world. And that also gave rise to most of the economic value that we're deriving and will continue to derive from AI today. And from the research side, you know, researchers figured out how to take these models, these statistical models at the end of the day, and make them much larger and scale it up in a way that's still trainable, sustainable, and also feed more and more data into it. And so that gave rise to deep learning. Neural networks and some of the terminology that we hear a lot today all came out of the machine learning revolution. And this deep learning phase, this really started about 15 years ago. That's when, if you track the size of AI models, it really took off exponentially compared to before, where most of the models you could actually kind of write down on a whiteboard. So the deep learning phase was enabled really by two things. Like, one was that the ability to scale up the models, but then two, there's kind of a silent hero in this, and that's a phenomenon captured by Moore's Law. Gordon Moore, a co-founder of Intel, essentially observed almost or over 60 years ago that processing power, basically the number of transistors on a chip, doubles every 2 years. And that's incredible, because I think there's no other technology out there that has become so efficient and continues to refine itself and increase its efficiency exponentially. And that exponential growth cannot be overstated. It's basically saying that every 2 years, we have the ability to make as much progress with computing power as we have made through the last 100 years, all of humanity. And that continues to hold true for now. We don't know how much longer, but in a sense, we are at today with these large language generative AI models simply because we can be. The supply has caught up and created enough space to crunch through words and complex relationships that we simply couldn't before. Another way to look at this is if you consider kind of a pocket calculator, it crunches numbers. There's 10 different numbers and a handful of operations. A basic pocket calculator needs on the order of 1,000 transistors to do that. The first publicly released GPT 3.5 model that powered ChatGPT, that had almost 200 billion relationships between words and fragments of words. And that was what was required, the level of complexity required to crunch through human language. Every language has, you know, over 10,000 commonly used words, and it was trained on multiple languages. And to do so would require kind of like the power of 100 million pocket calculators. And that's why we are where we are. Now, if we zoom into the generative AI side, because this is the hot topic everywhere, it has also gone through multiple stages of evolution over the past few years. The first stage, I would consider it to be kind of an illusion or appearance of intelligence. And this is why AI is suddenly kind of a popular phrase again. We're in an AI summer where everyone's talking about the phrase, where it's going to take us. And the thing that really kicked it off was these models are generating interesting stuff. They're saying amusing things. They're saying things that are kind of useful. And it didn't stop there. Now people started figuring out ways to give it more context into its kind of short-term memory. And that evolved it into presenting an appearance of knowledge, to have more relevant knowledge at its fingertips. And these days, this year especially, is kind of the year of agentic AI or reasoning AI. So it's giving an appearance of metacognition. Basically, by continually improving the models and its ability to try to take a step back and think about what it's doing, we're lengthening the time horizon that the model can independently act, more than kind of the initial maybe 5 seconds or 10 seconds of trying to pick and choose the next word or sentence to say, but now go off for a couple of minutes and work on tasks. And the other side of agentic AI is now there's increasing standardization of non-AI tools that the AI can use, so to actually have it act rather than just kind of fetch and retrieve knowledge. And so that's kind of where we are right now.
Well, a couple of things jump out to me, one being the amount of energy required to support, facilitate the functions of AI, yes, which is a whole separate conversation, though the extent of the history, because speaking for me and perhaps for others as well, I've only heard more about AI only in the past few years with applications I'm sure many of us are familiar with. But there really is a deep history behind this, which is quite fascinating. So just looking at where we are today, John, common day, present use cases, how is AI currently impacting our lives, perhaps in ways we don't even realize?
Certainly. The classical machine learning, that revolution that happened starting in the 90s, there's a big branch of that called supervised learning. And that's basically kind of, I give you a bunch of data, you tell me if this is good or bad. You tell me kind of what's tomorrow's temperature from 0 to 100 degrees. And that is everywhere. We don't really see it because we've stopped calling it AI. We don't, whenever the post office delivers mail, we don't say, oh, gosh, I'm really glad for the handwriting recognition neural network that read the handwriting and got my mail to me fast. It's just kind of fades into the background, and we treat it like we treat other software solutions. It's just a part of a specialized system that makes increasingly complex decisions over and over. What's tomorrow's weather? When's the next subway train coming? What is the amount of fuel that an aircraft will use given the current weather conditions? It's adding immense amounts of value, and this is a field that continues to grow. There's a lot of professionals that continue to work on this. Now, generative AI is the new kid on the block. Obviously, it's only been around public in the public eyesight for maybe the last 2 or 3 years. And the difference here, the paradigm shift, is that, like the name implies, the output is no longer constrained. And so it doesn't just kind of give a very kind of narrow output. It potentially can operate in a lot of areas that previously would not have been in the realm of a machine trying to operate in. And then the other part is that it's never been as commoditized and accessible as it has now. So the use cases that we're seeing here are perhaps immediately more on the productivity side. It's more bottom-up driven, where individuals are experimenting with it and finding value in dealing through kind of the tedium of knowledge work, searching through a lot of emails to find the one that says this thing that previously a search engine or other would have struggled with. And that is also in contrast with classical AI, which required kind of full-time staff, a top-down direction to bake it into a particular product. So it's a new area. It's not necessarily going to overlap or replace the traditional machine learning, but it certainly unlocks a lot of new avenues and use cases that previously wouldn't have been possible cost-wise or feasibility-wise otherwise.
Well, the email search function is one I use on a daily basis, quite helpful. And as a daily rail rider, it's helpful to know when exactly my train is scheduled to arrive. So there are quite a lot of practical use cases. But I know there's a lot of anticipation, excitement over where we're headed from here. So what does the future of AI impact look like from your vantage point?
So let's talk about generative AI. I think even if we made no more progress in kind of today's models are the best that we have access to, I think we're still just scratching the surface of where this can be applied. So in the short-term future, I see this as finding novel ways to chain together these kind of minute-level tasks into longer and longer horizon tasks. Internally, we found a lot of use with data analysis and research assistants that basically we think they can do the work of a good junior associate up to maybe 50 to 75% of what they can produce. But the crucial difference here is that in exchange for work that's maybe half as good, it's also 10,000 times faster. It's almost free. And if you can figure out how to scale this up, it unlocks new use cases that just previously wouldn't have been feasible, like searching on a risk perspective through draft regulations across different countries for that once in every few years sort of a risk item that is applicable to a portfolio. Areas that simply just would have been prohibitively expensive in the past. Now, in the longer term, the framework that I take here is more of an economic one. Like economics 101, you say technology is a multiplier on the productivity of labor and capital. And AI, I think, certainly is a technology, and I would argue that it's a general purpose technology. And as with other general purpose technologies like electricity or the transistor or the internet, the immediate applications of this might not be what we see down the line. It's going to take an entire web of interdependencies and things to solve out. So we're not going to see kind of immediate, imminent automation of everything across our economy. Different sectors will have different timelines depending on how they operate and specific concrete use cases that people apply there. But the common point is that there's really no area that will be untouched at the end of it. And with the way that the current generative AI technology is headed, the language models, there is kind of one bottleneck that I will point to as potentially this, if solved, would lead to the next step that I'll call the illusion or appearance of consciousness. What I mean by that is today's models have a long-term memory issue. They take millions of dollars to train over several months, and that model is that's the long-term memory of the model. When you talk with such a model, as soon as it's done typing back to you, it wipes itself clean and then starts serving the next user that's trying to type to it. And so everything that we do today to work around is to, at the very last minute, kind of show it a bunch of notes and last minute context on how the conversation has been going, any other information that might be useful. But that's not true long-term memory because the model is not really baking it into its thought process. It's not really changing it. And there's a few other terminologies out there like fine-tuning, where you blast question and answer pairs to it that tries to modify its thinking a little bit. It's just not the same as human cognition, where we're actually incorporating new information and dealing with the ambiguity of that fairly well. So maybe in the future, there's a lot of other intermediate steps to this point. But if we do find ways to start solving this long-term memory issue, then if we have AI models that produce a sense that they are have a persistent state of consciousness, we're in for some interesting times, because then the economic function is a little different now. It's not necessarily a technology multiplier just on the outside of the production function. It might enter the production function as a substitute or complement to labor. And we've got all sorts of interesting and challenging questions to deal with at that point, like division of labor. What is our relationship to AI that's working alongside us as colleagues or coworkers? Are we managers of them? Are we overseers? What are we? But it makes for some interesting times ahead. It could be very different architecture by then. But one thing that's not stopping is Moore's Law. We're going to get more and more computational power.
Well, there's definitely a lot of potential, a lot to still be figured out. And you think about the scale, scope of the economic consequences, implications of the labor market, as you alluded to in particular. So it will, of course, be fascinating to see how this further evolves from here. As with anything else, John, I'm curious, where do you see AI being under and overhyped?
That's a good question. I think relatively overhyped are the areas that are obviously visible today. And there's two sides, I think, especially to call out. One is the kind of purveyors and providers of AI models, or businesses that take the AI models and kind of wrap it up and try to sell a service as if like this AI will solve everything. And then the other side of that is the underlying hardware that runs it. You know, these are both real things and crucial parts of the ecosystem, but they're not all of it. And so I'd say the pure AI model side is potentially misleading to read into the developments there, because amidst this Cambrian explosion of AI models and developments, it seems like almost every week or so there's a new frontier model that comes out and it claims to be 20% better than the previous model. And by the way, our computers are 20 times as powerful as they were 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But the world doesn't really feel 20 times better, because you know, the physical world has a lot of, literally has a lot of momentum. And the same goes for people and organizational momentum in the form of kind of mindset shifts, habits, and processes. And so to actually have the technology work its way through from the core innovations we're seeing to actual application, it's going to take a while. And for the hardware side, I'd say it's potentially overhyped, if only for the reason of historically, this is the only time where we've had such a mismatch in supply and demand, whereas the models have been growing at 10 to 15 times every 2 years. You know, Moore's Law is 2 times every 2 years, both exponential, but a big gap in between. I'm not sure how long that can last. If there's at any point we kind of fall back to the mean and say, you know what, doubling the power every 2 years is great, well, then revenue growth for hardware providers is constant, or rather it's close to 0%. And historically, we've been a lot closer to 0% than 200%. Now, on the underhyped side, I'd say maybe what I consider the boring last mile problems of the AI ecosystem, and a lot of this might not even be AI. It might be things like data governance, making sure that AI, which by the way, at the end of the day is software, is deployed at scale safely, according to regulations, securely, reliably. And these are the same old problems that need to be solved, just at a higher scale and perhaps with a bit more urgency these days. And there are plenty of areas in the entire kind of architecture stack, if you will, for AI, that they work on these problems and it's their bread and butter. They're experts at it. And they haven't had a lot of attention because all the attention's on kind of the shiny surface.
Right. Now, in terms of words of caution, oftentimes you hear about people drawing comparisons to what they've seen in Hollywood films, TV shows. What are some words of caution with respect to AI that we should all be mindful of?
I think one is, if the choice is to try to apply AI somewhere, AI is not lotion. You can't just apply it. A better way to look at it would be to really take a holistic look at the entire problem. What are the specific concrete areas that could benefit from this? And what are the areas that are either prerequisites or kind of downstream beneficiaries? Historically, we've seen plenty of anecdotes that whenever there's a broad shift in something, the immediate beneficiaries are not always just the entities closest to that technology or that shift. The story goes that when air conditioning was invented, one of the biggest beneficiaries was desert real estate that suddenly became habitable and desirable. And, you know, the internet gave rise to e-commerce, which, worked out really well for the e-commerce companies or some e-commerce companies, but it also worked really well for logistics companies, warehouse REITs that focused on delivering logistics to large population centers. And so just saying, like, think of the second order and third order effects as the ecosystem changes. And the other thing is, this time, I think one thing that does feel a little different from past trends is the breadth and the speed of this. I don't know how long this is sustainable, but there's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in the race that people are investing in advancing the frontier and the scope of the frontier here. And just in light of that alone, I think it's important for all of us to try to think about how and where on the curve you want to take a stand on. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. And by that, I mean kind of maybe there's a specific business challenge that if you can solve and stay 6 months ahead of your competitors, it's worth it. So it's worth to be on the cutting edge of, say, generative AI development. And it's worth the disproportionate development costs and potentially disproportionate risk to do so. Or maybe the answer is, you know, I'm fine waiting up to a year for the technology to diffuse its way up the value chain, and my suppliers will find ways to make me productive through this. That might be fine too. But the only word of caution to tag on to that is, given the speed and scope of the change, if the decision is, I don't want anything to do with this, that's almost effectively a short position on AI, and that's as active as diving headfirst into it.
That's a great way to put it. And there is a lot of runway ahead of us with this story, which is exciting, lends itself to future follow-up conversations. Would be great to have you back, John, at some point to further talk about this evolution. Though, for the purposes of today, any final thoughts, takeaways, or anything you would like to reinforce to our listeners?
Well, thank you. I'd like to share maybe my own North Star that I've been following, you know, since school and working with these models back in school, a lot more primitive models, certainly. But it's been a gradual realization that I think, to me, the role of AI, the most valuable part of it, is in teaching us what is not uniquely human. You know, things like transcribing speech, looking at road signs and markings and recognizing where they are and tugging the steering wheel left and right a little, doing translations, summarizing really long documents. This stuff has, once it teaches us this, it has freed us up to then focus on the core attributes that really make us human, which for now, anyway, include things like creativity, curiosity, empathy. And that, to me, is the AI transformation. And this is going to be more of a journey. And increasingly, it's going to be, I would suspect, more of a co-evolution or adaptation as we wrangle with what it means for us individually, what it means for us organizationally or as a society. And to prepare for that journey, you know, pack a healthy dose of critical thinking, skepticism, and bring some real use cases and experiment with it.
Well, John, this has been very eye-opening, very educational. Personally, I took a lot away from your conversation, your insight. So thank you again for dropping by the UBS On Air studio and spending some time with our clients, our listeners here on UBS On Air Market Moves.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights, at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements statements and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.